So going back to the measurements lab, if you look at the calculation sheet, page 15, if you remember, all that we were doing in part A was looking at precision, but also indirectly accuracy of some different pieces of glassware. So one thing you might have noticed is that the volume that you measured with the different pieces of glassware might have really changed as you went from one to the other. And that just reinforces the idea that graduated cylinders, even though they measure out a certain amount of liquid, they're not the most precise or accurate pieces of glassware. So I remember some of you had commented that you saw the values change, and that's actually normal. So that's why these are only used to measure out approximate volumes, and if we really wanted a better number, we would use a burette or some other piece of glassware to measure. As far as what values you reported, for the 10-milliliter graduated cylinder, since you had the markings in between each milliliter, you'd most likely have two significant figures in your answers. So if I look back, I see that you were supposed to measure out about 8 milliliters of water. So suppose you had filled it up to exactly 8, then you don't just write the number 8 down, because you did have those finer graduations on the markings. So in other words, you should have 8.0. So I just want to point that out because we had discussed significant figures. The fact that we have the ability to measure better than just the milliliter is why you've got to make sure that you include that extra digit. So if you did have just a single digit in your answer, like 8, that really should be 8.0 instead. Now for the 100-milliliter graduated cylinder, all you had was milliliter markings, and so it wasn't going to be really possible for you to get any more information out. So very likely you only had one digit as far as your measurement there. And certainly for the beaker, there are hardly any markings on the beaker. So you had to estimate even to figure out what the volume was. So as far as what you wrote down, again, for number one, the 10-milliliter graduated cylinder, you should have had 2 sig figs. But for 2 and 3, you most likely only had 1 sig fig. Now, if we move on to the known sample for part B, remember you were supposed to use just regular old tap water for measuring out the density for the known liquid. And I had written down that known value for the density. So item number 2, the true value, that was 0.997 grams per milliliter. Now, as far as the measurements, the mass of the empty 10-milliliter graduated cylinder, you should have 4 digits after the decimal point, because we have really precise balances that give you all that information. If you didn't write it all down, then realize for the future, anytime that you're measuring mass, because we have the types of balances that we have, you should have 4 digits after each decimal point. So that would be the same for item 3 and item 4, where you'd gone back and measured the mass of the graduated cylinder with the liquid in it. Now, from rules of subtraction and addition, since both of those numbers had the same number of digits after the decimal point, we keep that same number of digits in our answer for number 5, the mass of the liquid. To get the mass of the liquid, all we would do is take item 4, which is the mass of the cylinder and the liquid, subtract out number 3. And then if you lined up the numbers, you see again that we have the same number of digits after the decimal point. So you should have 4 digits after the decimal point for item number 5 as well. Now, for the volume of the liquid, we were back to using a 10-milliliter graduated cylinder. So for trial 1 and 2, you were supposed to have about 5 or 8 milliliters for 1 and then for 2. So you probably had 2 significant figures again for your answer. So same thing here, that if you got an exact number like 5, that really should be 5.0. Now, for trial 3, since you were supposed to be closer to 10, if you really had 10 milliliters, then you had 3 significant figures in your answer, because you would have had 10.0. Now, for the density of the liquid, that would be taking item number 5, the mass, and divided it by item number 6, which is the volume. Since the volume had the lower number of sig figs, that's going to determine how many sig figs you keep for the density. So, in other words, if you're trial, you only had 2 significant figures for your volume, then by rules of multiplication and division, you're only going to keep those two sig figs in your answer. So most likely for trial one and trial two, you only had two sig figs for your density. And maybe if you had a volume that was 10 milliliters for trial three, you might have kept three sig figs. Now for the average, you're supposed to add up all the densities and divide by three. Since the number three is a counting number, it's an exact number, its number of sig figs doesn't matter. So in other words, you could pretend that the number three has an infinite number of sig figs. So for the average density, it's going to be based off of the number of sig figs you had in your density itself. So if your densities, you kept two sig figs for each one of them, you're going to keep two sig figs for your average as well. The only exception being is that if you ended up with 0.995 or something like that, then when you round up, you are going to make that 1.00. So it's a small exception to the way that you handle the sig figs. We didn't calculate percent range because that's not something we normally do. All that that was trying to show you is that there might be some variation in the results that you got. So you can skip number 9 on the sheet here. And then number 10, you were supposed to calculate percent error. Now, you might remember me discussing that the formula in the text is actually incorrect in my view. That the way that it's written out, I think that they meant to put absolute value signs in for the formula instead of parentheses like what they had here. So if you're not using absolute signs, it really should be your experimental value that goes first. Then you subtract out the true value, the 0.997 that I'd quoted earlier. Then you're going to divide by that true value and multiply by 100%. So again, in this case, it's going to be the number of sig figs in your densities that'll tell you how many sig figs to keep for your percent error. So that's for the calculation of the known sample. It's going to be the same set of calculations for the unknown sample. Now, all of these unknown solutions were sodium chloride or salt solutions. They were just different mass percentages. Mass percent means how much of the sodium chloride versus the total mass of the solution. So if you had unknown number one, that's the one that had the red label on it, that was a 1% solution, and the known density was 1.005. So depending on which unknown number you had, you want to write this number down for your true value for the unknown section. So again, for sample one, the red label, its density was 1.005. For number two, that happened to be a 5% solution. That's the one that had the yellow label on it, and that density is 1.034. Then if you had unknown three, that's the one with the green label. That was a 10% solution, and that density was 1.071. And then last one, if you had unknown number four, that's the one that had the orange label. That was a 20% solution, and that density was 1.148. So each of you might have a different number for your densities. Did anybody need those numbers over again? Well, which sample? Number one, that was 1.005. Number three was 1.071. Number two, 1.034. Okay, so as far as doing the calculations, it's exactly what we had in the known sample. So again, for the masses, all the masses will have four digits after the decimal point. Your measurements themselves, because you directly observed them off the balances, and then rules of addition and subtraction, when you come up with the mass of the liquid, that's item three minus item two, that's also going to have four digits after the decimal point. Your volume was again measured with a 10 milliliter graduated cylinder, so most likely you had two sig figs, and so your densities will have two sig figs in them. The average density, same thing again, exact numbers like three, we ignore sig figs, so your densities will determine how many sig figs your average density you kept. Again, item number eight, you're going to skip that. We didn't do that one. The identity of the unknown, I just gave you what those unknowns were. And then you'll calculate the percent error based off of the densities that I just read out to you all. So that's for part B. Any questions on any of those calculations so far? Then part C, even though you might have written down a sample number, it unfortunately turns out I don't have a reference for the known values. So you're not going to be calculating any percent error for part C. And remember that we only did the regular solid. You can completely skip page 17, which we may talk about these questions on page 17 later on, but you don't have to do these post-lab questions as part of your exercise. You only need to focus on the calculations. So for the mass of the sample, same as the masses of up above, those should have had four digits after the decimal point. For your sample dimensions, since you used the rulers most likely that were in the lab text, you had one that had millimeters. So you probably had either two sig figs or three sig figs, depending on how large your object was. And since you're multiplying all those numbers together, whichever number had the lowest number of sig figs, that's how many sig figs you're going to keep for your volume. So, of course, if you had a rectangular object, it's just the length times the width times the height. If you had the cylindrical object, the diameter you divide by 2 to get the radius, then it's pi r squared, with r being the radius, times the height. That gives you the volume. So, again, the lowest number of sig figs you had in any of the individual measurements, that's going to tell you how many sig figs you keep for that volume. And since density we're dividing, and the volume had the lowest number of sig figs, that volume is going to tell you how many sig figs to keep for the density. So you're going to have plenty of time to finish out the experiment today. We're going to be done early, most likely. And so you've got time to finish this worksheet out. So by the end of the lab period today, if you turn these in, then we'll be finished with experiment number 1. So any questions at all? Then let's move on to what we're supposed to be doing today, which is an analysis of mass. This is what would be more formally known as gravimetric analysis. And what we're trying to do is determine the percentage of water in popcorn. So this is the non-chemical equivalent of an experiment we do in the Chem 1 class, where in the Chem 1 class we use a type of compound known as a hydrate. So a hydrate is a substance that has water incorporated in it as part of its molecular structure. It doesn't just mean something that's wet, because I could throw sugar in water and that would be wet, but it's more specifically where water becomes part of the structure of that substance. So to minimize use of chemicals, we're using popcorn instead, which, if you didn't realize, the reason that popcorn pops is there is some amount of water that's trapped inside a popcorn kernel. And if the outside casing of that kernel is intact enough, if you heat up the water on the inside, eventually it tries to evaporate. Well, water in its gas form takes up a lot more volume, takes up a lot more room than its liquid form. So there develops all this pressure inside the kernel, and that's what eventually causes it to pop. And so essentially what we're going to be doing is measuring the mass of these popcorn kernels before they pop. We'll measure the mass afterwards. And the difference between the two is going to be the amount of water that was trapped in that kernel. And then we're going to be calculating the percent of mass that was water in that kernel. Now, if you look at the diagram on page 28, we're supposed to be doing an indirect heating. So normally we would be using a Bunsen burner to heat up a beaker to generate hot air. The reason that we're doing that and not just heating the kernels directly in that case is we don't want to burn them, because if we start burning them, that's a chemical reaction that will change the mass besides just getting rid of the water. So in this setup on that diagram, you have what's called an evaporating dish where the kernels are supposed to sit, and then that's on top of the beaker. So, the kernels would be in this dish, and so they're indirectly heated by the hot air that would be in the beaker, that the beaker is being heated by the Bunsen burner. Now, because of the room that we're in, we're not going to end up using the Bunsen burners today, although I did want to do a demonstration of Bunsen burners just in case you end up using them in the future. So what we're going to be doing instead is using what's called a hot plate, which you might not be able to see it from where you're seated, but up here, the devices that have the yellow casing, those are hot plate stirrers. So one knob is to heat, one knob is to do stirring. I think I might have already mentioned the idea of magnetic stirring, where you have a magnet that's on the underside of that top there, and then you'll have a magnet that you put in the beaker to stir it. Because we're using the hot plates instead of a Bunsen burner, we got a little bit more control over the heating, so we're actually going to do direct heating instead. The one thing I got to tell you is don't turn the heat all the way up on the hot plates, because they do get hot enough that they could scorch the popcorn. So your setup will be pretty simple. If this is the hot plate, then you'll have just a beaker where you're going to put your kernels in. You'll have what's known as a stir bar. The stir bar is a magnet that's inside of a plastic coating. That plastic coating's not going to react. And the reason we use that is you're going to slowly spin the kernels around just to keep them from sticking in one place and to help avoid them getting overheated, getting scorched. Instead of an evaporating dish, on top you're going to use what's called a watch glass. That's a slightly curved piece of glassware that we use often to evaporate off solutions to recover crystals. In this case, the reason you're using it is if we're trying to measure the mass of the popcorn after it pops, we don't want it flying out of the beaker. So it's to physically keep the popcorn inside the beaker while it's popping. So let me just walk through the procedure itself. The procedure says to set up the equipment. Again, we're using this modified form that's a lot simpler, in fact, than what you're supposed to be doing. Number two says using the balance as described. So I already told you about the balance, making sure to keep the windows closed to avoid the air currents. Also, at the end, after we heated, you might remember that I said that we couldn't put hot objects directly on the balance. And that's not because we're trying to protect the balance, although that's a part of it. It's because if you have a hot object inside that balance, it can heat the air inside that environment that causes lift, which causes the values then to change. So, of course, before you do the experiment, everything's cooled off, so you can go ahead and measure directly. So you're supposed to measure the mass of the beaker. Where it says evaporating dish, remember we're replacing that with the beaker because we're going to be heating directly. So then you get approximately 10 kernels. We have two different popcorn samples up here, so you should do sample A first, and then you are going to repeat the procedure for B. Even though you're doing the whole thing twice, like I said, you're likely going to be finished quite early because this does go pretty quickly. So for the first sample, you'll measure out about 10 kernels, and then you'll get the combined mass of your beaker and the popcorn. Then you place the beaker on the hot plate, since we're not using the Bunsen burner, and you'll cover it with the watch glass. The watch glass you don't need to get the mass of, because the popcorn is not likely going to stick to it. So you can ignore it in your mass calculations. Again, because we're making a small switch in the procedure, before you put that watch glass on there, there'll be a stir bar, which all the equipment, again, is located over in the front of the classroom, just like it was in the last class. So you'll put the stir bar in there, and you'll turn the heat on probably about halfway, whatever the knob setting is for the heat. If you put it about halfway, that's probably hot enough to get it to do what we need it to do, but probably not so hot so we avoid scorching the kernels. The stir bar, you don't want to turn up to high speed because that will be too aggressive. You might cause things to bump too much. But you do want it to be gently stirring, again, to keep the kernels from just sticking in place and possibly getting overheated. So as long as the kernels are moving inside around the beaker, then that's all you really need. It says to heat the kernels until they all pop. But if they don't all pop, it says to continue heating before up until the point they start turning brown. The reason it has you keep on heating is the text claims that if the kernels don't pop, well, that's because there's some small opening or something on the surface of that kernel that's still going to allow the water to escape. So in other words, it still will be a valid measurement even if it doesn't physically pop. So after all the popcorn has popped, or after you've heated it up sufficiently, then you let it cool down again and get that new combined mass of the popped kernels and the beaker. Then, since we're not using chemicals, the popcorn can just be disposed of. Hopefully, even if you haven't had your breakfast, you do realize that we're using lab glassware that might have been chemically contaminated in the past. So the option to eat the popcorn is not a good one, right? So you just dump it in the trash, and then you're going to repeat the whole process over again with the sample B. Now, as far as writing out your data table, just to review that, again, for sample one and two, the brand of popcorn, we've got that hidden. They're just labeled as samples A and B. You have the mass of the evaporating dish, which, again, remember, write down all the digits that the balance gives you, so four digits after the decimal point. You have the mass of the kernels before heating combined with the mass of that beaker. And just to write it out for you, item four there, which is the mass of the kernels before heating. That's going to be the mass of the beaker and kernels. Remember, the beaker is being substituted for the evaporating dish. So the mass of the beakers and kernels, that's item three. And then the mass of the beaker, item two. You subtract the two, and that'll give you the mass of the kernels before heating. So then afterwards, you're going to measure the combined mass of the popped kernels and the beaker. So that's item five. And then the mass of the popped corn. Which is item six. That's going to be the mass of the beaker and the popped corn, which is item five. And then again, you're going to subtract out just the mass of the beaker itself, which was item two. Then the whole point is we're trying to figure out how much water was driven off the kernels. So that's item seven. So the mass of the water driven from the kernels item seven, that's going to be the mass of the kernels themselves, meaning the mass of the kernels before heating, so that was item four from up above, and then you have the mass of the popcorn, which will be without the water. And that was item six that we calculated up above. So then the last thing it asks you to calculate is the mass percent of water. So mass percent of water would be the mass of just the water itself, which is item 7 that we just calculated, versus divided by the original mass of the kernels, which is item 4. And then this is in terms of percent, so we multiply the whole thing by 100%. So the questions, again, you don't need to answer. We'll discuss those maybe next time. But all you need to do is to complete out the data. Since we've already gone over the calculations, if you finished off the calculations today, you could turn these sheets in as well if you just wanted to be done with the experiment. And again, you can either rip out the pages if you're not planning to resell the book, or if you copy it on another sheet or photocopy the page and fill it out, either way is fine. For those of you that showed up a little late, I did go over the calculations for the first experiment. If you wanted to get the information from someone else that was here, all I did was to review a little bit about sig figs to make sure that you had filled them out correctly. But if you either today or if you needed to catch up on how to do them, by next time, if you turn in those first sheets, we're already done with that first experiment. And like I said, we just went over the current experiment, so if you wanted to turn that in to be done with it, you could as well. Now, like I mentioned earlier, we're not actually using the Bunsen burners because we don't have enough Bunsen burner stations in the classroom. But like I said, I did want to do a demonstration of using one just in case we get to use them in the future. So if you all could just come back to the back of the classroom here, I'm going to grab a Bunsen burner just so I could talk about it and demonstrate it. So if you all wanted to just come back here. So a Bunsen burner is a pretty simple device. It's got two valves on it. The valve on the bottom is for the gas. The valve on the top is for the air. Why do we have an air valve? Well, because initially when we light it, if we have the air circulating through it, it actually makes it more difficult to light. But eventually we do want this open because if you provide enough oxygen, then you get what's called complete combustion. So complete combustion, the main product that you get out is carbon dioxide, which is what we breathe out once we respire. So that gives a hotter flame, which I'll demonstrate in just a moment. The valve works off the normal principle of righty-tighty left, which means if you're looking at the valve itself and twist it to the right, that closes it off. If you twist it to the left, that'll open it up. When you do close it off, initially you're going to get what's called incomplete combustion, which means there's not enough oxygen to fully react with the gas. And you'll end up getting carbon monoxide as one of the products. Now, in a room like this with so much ventilation, that's not going to really matter. But carbon monoxide is the reason that for those of you who have non-electric cars, you've got what's known as a catalytic converter as part of your tailpipe assembly, which that contains a metal, usually something expensive like platinum or palladium, that will react with carbon monoxide that comes out of the engine to process it before it gets out into the open atmosphere. Because if you've never seen one of these murder mystery setups, if you are in an enclosed space with one of these types of gas-burning cars, and if you build up an accumulation of carbon monoxide, it is toxic. It can actually be fatal. Because what happens, you may know, when you breathe, is that the oxygen you take in through your lungs ends up combining with what's called hemoglobin, something that floats through the bloodstream. Oxygen attaches to hemoglobin, it's transported to different parts of the body. Oxygen comes in, then the cells oxide does an even better job of sticking to the hemoglobin. So if you're stuck in an enclosed space and you breathe in carbon monoxide, well, that sticks to the hemoglobin instead of oxygen, which means there's no more you. So carbon monoxide is one of the products of incomplete combustion, but like I said, in this setup here, we don't really need to worry so much about how much carbon monoxide's generated. Now, for the gas valve, it does work the same way where if you're looking at the valve, You turn it to the right to close it off. You turn it to the left to open it up, but normally we're not going to be using the Bunsen burner pointed down like this. So when the Bunsen burner is seated the normal way, it's going to be backwards. Where if you're looking at the valve from up top, you turn it to the right to open it, you turn it to the left to close it. Which you can tell which way it's going because this is just a pin. It's a screw that's used to turn off or block the flow of gas. So as you open it up, it will physically unscrew the pin and you'll see it lower down away from the Bunsen burner. You have to be careful because if you did turn it too much, it's potentially possible you'll pull it all the way out. So as you tighten it up, you'll see it go back up into the Bunsen burner. And we're going to start with it closed off because we do want to make sure that the gas tube that we're using doesn't have any leaks in it. I mean, when you have a piece of rubber like this that's pretty stretchable, if you look at the surface of it and you don't see any cracks, likely it's fine. But what we're going to do is we're going to plug it in, turn on the gas, and make sure that we don't hear or smell anything. Of course, natural gas doesn't have an odor. It's something that's added to it. There's a sulfur-containing compound that's added just in tiny quantities because human nose is really sensitive to the smell of sulfur. So if you smell gas, that's actually the additive that's used to make sure that you know that there's a gas leak. Now, one thing to know about that, though, is that the human nose, although it's sensitive to sulfur, it could also acclimate to sulfur, meaning that over time, you get what you could call nose blind to it, meaning you won't smell it any longer. So somebody that's outside the room that walks in will all of a sudden say, oh my goodness, can't you smell that? And no, if you've been in that environment, maybe you won't smell it. So I don't hear anything, I don't smell anything, so it looks like this hose is fine. So I'm going to go ahead and light the Bunsen burner. Now the way that we do it here in the lab is we use a striker, which has got a piece of flint, a piece of stone on it, that's being pushed up against a rough grating. Now people kind of get nervous about the striker because as you can see, it does make these bright sparks. And I guess being a chemistry instructor, I must like pain of some sort. So I'll demonstrate here that if you do get the striker on you, I mean, it'll sting just a tiny bit, but it's not so bad. The reason I'm demonstrating that is because people are nervous about this, they'll turn the gas on, and then they'll sit here with the striker like this. And never get the spark going. Meanwhile, the whole time there's gas building up here. So when you finally get the guts to do a spark and light it, you get the fireball that is exactly what you're not wanting to have happen. So I'm going to turn this on and just get a spark. And you can see that in this room, here's one of the other problems we have with using the Bunsen burners. We got so much airflow in here that the flame's being driven off inside this fume hood. So this is actually way too large a flame. I'm going to turn this down a little bit. Now, most humans have the response of fire bad. So again, as you're lighting this thing, as long as you move your hands away in time, you're not going to get burned. Because if you did just keep moving, this flame is cold enough that... wait, this is one of those things, don't do this at home, right? I know I'm going to get pulled into the dean's office one of these days doing this. I'm just trying to show you that if you do have the normal reaction to move away from fire, that this is a cool enough flame that you're not going to instantly get burned. Because this may be red hot or orange hot, but that's not actually the hottest kind of flame. If I did open up this air valve, you can see that I'm now generating a blue flame, which I'm not going to pass my hand through that because that's blue hot, which is actually a lot hotter than red hot. And the hottest part of the flame is actually, if you can see it from where you're standing, there's like a lighter, brighter blue part of the flame and then a less intense color flame around that. So it's right at the tip of that brightest part of the flame that's the hottest part. So if we were doing the experiment with the Bunsen burner, that's where you'd actually want to use to heat the beaker up. So this is where complete combustion is going on. Now, what if you had some sort of accident like that? Well, what are we going to do? Sit here and watch the lab burn down so you can go home? So it's sitting here heating up the benchtop. What do? Turn it off where? At the gas valve. If you do have something that happens like this, you don't want to try to reach for it just in case you burn yourself in the process of trying to right it. And you don't want to try to fiddle with the valve here. Turn it off at the main source first, and then relight it once you've got everything stabilized again. Of course, this demonstrates why you don't want to keep your lab books or anything else flammable around a Bunsen burner when you're lighting it, just in case something accidentally does happen and you knock it over like that. Okay? So just wanted to have shown you using the Bunsen burner, even though we're not using it today. So does anyone have any questions about any of the calculations or what to do for the lab today? So even though we're just using popcorn, even though chemicals aren't involved, we still have glassware that you're using. So you do still need to have your safety goggles on, because if a piece of glass did shatter and go flying, then that's as much of a hazard as a chemical is. So again, if you don't have your goggles, then you'll need to check them out from the stockroom. But if there aren't any questions, then let's go ahead and get going.